From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca, in for Ira Flatow. For the rest of this hour, we'll talk with Mike Bishop. He thinks all of us should make more of an effort to understand science. Don't worry, I don't think he's going to have us haul out our biology textbooks. But he says we need to understand science because it's part of our culture. Think evolution, genetics, and space exploration. So why should we listen to Mike Bishop on these topics? Well, he heads up the University of California at San Francisco. That's one possible reason. Oh, yes, and there's that Nobel Prize he won back in 1989 for his research on cancer. So, you know, maybe he's got something to tell or something to say. So if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now let me formally introduce my guest. Dr. J. Michael Bishop is a 1989 Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine and the author of How to Win the Nobel Prize, An Unexpected Life in Science, out this year from Harvard University Press. He joins me today from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Bishop.
Thank you, Joe.
So I've read this entire book, which I enjoyed, but I have to tell you, at the end of it, I still don't know how to win a Nobel Prize. So I think you've given me a little bait and switch here. What's going on?
Oh, the title was tongue-in-cheek. It started out that way as a lecture series, and I just left it. And, of course, the marketing people loved it.
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, seriously, why did you take on this book? What was your initial motivation?
The motivation stemmed from the lecture series. I was asked to give a series of lectures in Jerusalem, jointly sponsored by the Harvard University Press, and one of the prices of getting to go to Jerusalem was to put the lectures into a book afterwards. I've taken the opportunity throughout my career to talk to the general public about science, particularly the science I do, in the hope that I could assist the public in understanding what scientists do, why they do it, why it's important. So this was my first opportunity to put it into press with anything resembling a wide distribution. Mm-hmm. So I did it.
And you call this book, the subtitle is An Unexpected Life in Science. Tell us a little bit about why you say unexpected. What was your background?
Well, I was born and raised in a small town in rural Pennsylvania. My father was a country preacher. I gave no thought to being a scientist until I was halfway through medical school. When I finally woke up to the fact that my intellect and my personal aspirations conformed most to becoming a medical scientist rather than becoming a physician. And it took a while to achieve that afterwards. So it was thoroughly unexpected, not only on my part, but my parents' part, to the day she left us. My mother kept asking, "Now, what is it, Michael, exactly that you do instead of being a doctor?"
Well, that's the other thing. I think a lot of people, or at least I get the sense that a lot of people, seem to think that doctors equal scientists. What's the difference?
The difference, I think, is in discovery. Now, physicians can discover things. There's an honorable tradition of that by shrewd observation and pursuit. But the scientist is absolutely devoted to discovery. The physician is devoted to caring for the ill and to preventing disease. But the scientist is devoted to discovery. And, of course, some physicians are scientists. We have many clinical scientists, for example, the physicians who are studying clinical problems in a scientific way. That's the fundamental difference. One is devoted to delivery of health care in principle. The other is devoted to discovery in principle.
So how did the transformation take place that moved you from doctor to researcher?
First of all, my innate curiosity, my response to what I was learning early in medical school about the human body and the human condition, and secondly, peer influence. I went to college at a small liberal arts college where there was no research. I really was ignorant of research when I entered medical school, and for the first time I encountered peers, fellow students, who already had research experience, whose approach to the medical curriculum and to learning in general appealed to me, conformed to my own, and who convinced me that research was really worth my considering. So I mark it up to part personal, just a personal proclivity, and partly to a great deal, actually, to peer influence.
And what was the first problem you tackled? I mean, yeah, how did you decide which direction to go in of the many different scientific areas that existed?
By the end of my second year of medical school, I was thoroughly confused. It was becoming apparent I didn't want to become a practicing physician, that I wanted to be a medical scientist, but on the other hand, I was utterly unprepared to take that on. And fortunately, one of my instructors in a pathology course picked up on this and offered me a federally funded fellowship to take a year away from medical school and work in his research laboratory and in the pathology department at the Massachusetts General Hospital. I leaped at that opportunity. After all, it was a paid year off from medical school. That's a pretty good bargain to strike. And I was free to, first of all, teach myself, to read in the areas that had attracted me in medical school, particularly the then emerging field called molecular biology, and to tinker in the lab. At that point, I had no defined purpose. But when I returned to medical school, I took an elective course about viruses, and that hooked me. I was fascinated by the ability of these truly simple devices to seduce the cell into replicating them, and to their ability, and fascinated by their ability to cause disease. So I hooked up with an instructor at Harvard Medical School, Elmer Pfefferkorn, who later became chairman of microbiology at Dartmouth School of Medicine, and worked in my spare time during the third year of medical school studying a virus, trying to figure out a particular aspect of how it replicated. That's what started it. I continued to study viruses, and that led me eventually to an interest in viruses that cause cancer, and that led eventually to my study of the more fundamental aspects of cancer and our the work that Harold Varmus and I did on cancer genes. So it was a fairly rational progression once I got started, but it took me quite a while to get started.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join this conversation. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 989-TALK. And let's go to a call now. Jamie in Medford, Oregon. Welcome to the program. What's your question?
Yes, good afternoon, Joe. Science Friday is one of my favorite programs. I always try to tune it in on Fridays.
Good day to pick.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. Perhaps your guest could address this. It's like my field of expertise is electronics, and I'm always getting people like saying, "Oh, so you're in electronics? So, I've got a television I can fix that you can fix, or a telephone or something like that." And I always ask them, first of all, you have the schematic for it? And they say, "What's the schematic?"
Yeah.
And so it's like people are really. They seem to think that people that have sort of an esoteric knowledge of things can like kind of like do things off the top of their head, so to speak. And I was just wondering what your guest had to think about that. Where people, when they find out what their level of expertise is, they say, well, can you do this or can you do that? And how does he respond to that?
Well, what about that, Dr. Bishop?
Other than Nobel Prizes winning, yeah.
Well, that's a way to prove your bona fides, I guess.
Yeah,
it helped. Before the trip to Stockholm, even everybody from taxi drivers to lawyer friends, once they found out that I was doing cancer research, would immediately ask for advice about treatments, or more interestingly, perhaps commentary on what actually causes cancer. And I welcome those questions. Now, I'm not authoritative on treatment, but I went far enough in medical training. I had 2 years of postgraduate training in internal medicine before finally getting full-time into research. So I felt I could comment at a level the laity could handle on therapies, current therapies, and the future. And certainly in the issue of cause, I'm pretty well versed. So I actually welcome those questions, and I think it's a challenge to explain these things in ordinary terms, to find the similes, the metaphors, the figures of speech that convey the essence of things without using jargon. It's great fun to do that, and it takes practice, but it pays big dividends, I think.
Jamie, thanks very much for the question.
I would say is that when people ask me what was wrong with their television or something like that, I'd ask, like the guest is saying, I would ask them what it is that's wrong with it. What are the symptoms? And then I would address that in a very, very general terms and try not to use as much jargon as possible.
Interesting.
Well, yeah, the word of caution here, I think a person with medical background like myself, and I'm not even licensed as a physician anymore, and I think even physicians in a casual contact simply can't respond the same way an electronics expert might respond about a radio.
It's not that serious.
Yeah, exactly. It's a mistake to try to do an on-site diagnosis. It could mislead people severely.
Jamie, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate it. Well, since you're talking about finding metaphors, maybe I can ask you to give a lay explanation of what it is that you and Harold Varmus did that shed light on cancer and won you the prize.
At the time Harold and I began our work, the root mechanisms of cancer, the gadgetry that might be going wrong in a cancer cell was not known. There were hints in the past that genes might be involved in this, but there was also pretty strenuous opposition to that idea, in part because of evidence that cancer is generally due to external causes, sunlight, cigarette smoke, x-rays, etc. On the other hand, scientists knew that nature abounds in viruses that can cause cancer in a variety of animals, and eventually we even found such viruses in humans. We chose to study a chicken virus that causes cancer in chickens, and if placed into cells in test tubes, we'll convert those cells to pretty good facsimiles of cancer cells. The rapidity with which this happens in the laboratory, say the cells can be converted in 24 hours, really suggested that the virus is acting directly and immediately on the control mechanism of the cell. And that led easily at least for scientists with our background, to the suspicion that the virus must have the genetic apparatus to directly alter the behavior of the cell, one or more cancer genes. We weren't the first to show that, but once it was shown, we had to ask ourselves the question, what's that gene doing in a virus? It had no obvious purpose for the virus, to simplify the matter a bit. And that led to the suspicion that maybe the virus had accidentally acquired the gene from the cells in which it propagates. There was precedent for this. It had been known before that viruses can acquire genes from normal cells. So we initiated, Harold and I initiated, along with some younger colleagues, an inquiry to ask whether this cancer gene in this chicken virus, named for a scientist called Peyton Rouse, whether this cancer gene in the Rouse virus might have been acquired from the normal cell. And to my astonishment, the answer was yes.
So the virus was taking a human gene.
It had captured a human. It had captured, in this case, a chicken gene.
Yeah.
But we found the same gene in humans. Uh-huh. This gene is highly conserved through species. You can find it in essentially every multicellular organism. So there it was. This normal cell contained a normal gene, which, when captured by a virus, could become a cancer gene.
Pardon me one second, yes. Dr. Varmus. I just need to remind people that I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Sorry, thanks, Dr. Bishop. I think I said that
wrong. That's all right. Harold and I are used to that.
He's sort of been on my mind this week after reading your book. But go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you in the middle of your description.
Sure. The next thing that happened was that a large number of genes of this sort were found, genes that could be captured by viruses and converted into cancer genes. Why did they become cancer genes? Because they were damaged during the capture. They were mutated in the terms of genetics. Well, it was a pretty easy leap of faith to suspect that these genes, as they exist in normal cells, might be damaged by the typical causes of cancer: chemicals, X-rays, ultraviolet light in sun, smoke, cigarette smoke, etc. And to make a long story short, and to simplify just a bit, that's exactly what turned out to be the case. This humble chicken virus had led us to a large family of genes which are involved in causing or creating cancer in humans, because they are vulnerable to damage by any of the external causes of cancer. So they are, if you will, the mediator of cancer causes. The causes are typically external. They cause genetic damage. When this damage happens to hit this class of genes, trouble arises in the form of the cell gradually acquiring the ability to become a cancer cell.
It's a great story, and well, it's hard to know, but why don't we let some of our callers ask the follow-on questions. Let's go to Teresa in Louisville, Kentucky. Teresa, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I have a real quick question, and then I can take my answer off air. Is there or will there be any kind of screening for people to see if they are genetically predisposed? I have a family history of cancer. I have six siblings, none of which have been affected yet, but just wondering, is that a possibility in the future? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Teresa.
It's not only a possibility in the future, it's a reality now. For breast cancer, for example, we know of at least two related genes which, if damaged, can create a susceptibility to cancer, to breast cancer. These genes, damaged versions of these genes, are inherited in some families that have a high risk of breast cancer, and members of these families can be screened to see whether the genes are damaged. Now, only about 5 to 10% of cancer is actually caused by inherited damage to genes. The rest is acquired during the course of our lifetime. That's one of the reasons cancers typically arise in adults. It takes a while for all this to happen. So the screening, the initial screening, will simply be directed to inherited causes of cancer, and they're less common by far than the external causes of cancer.
Okay, I have to ask you actually to pause for a second, Dr. Bishop, because we have to take a short break, but we'll be right back after this break. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour with J. Michael Bishop, a 1989 Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine, and author of How to Win the Nobel Prize, An Unexpected Life in Science, out this year from Harvard University Press. We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 989-TALK. And Dr. Bishop, when we left, we were talking about the difference between inherited genes that cause cancer and some other kinds of genes that cause cancer. So do you want to pick that up?
Well, first, to be pedantic, all genes are inherited.
Okay.
So what we're talking about is inherited damage to a particular gene that predisposes an individual to cancer. And that predisposition is most obviously reflected in the fact that the cancers come on at a relatively early age. So in families where breast cancer is being inherited, if you will, where damage to one or another of these BRCA genes, as they're called, is being inherited, the breast cancer occurs at an uncommonly early age, as early as 20-25. So that's a dead giveaway that the cancer has a head start by virtue of an inherited damage to a cancer gene. Now, the rest of cancer that we say is not inherited is still caused by damage to genes, but it's damage that occurs in single individuals as they age, and that damage is not passed on because it doesn't occur typically in the sperm or the egg. It occurs in cells of our other tissues. That leads to an individual cancer, perhaps, in 1 in 4 of Americans. But the damage gene is lost to history once the individual dies.
I see. Okay. So that's what people sometimes refer to as sporadic cancer?
That's sporadic cancer, yes, exactly.
Okay.
It's pretty high frequency sporadic cancer okay. when you consider the risk in developed nations. But
sure.
It is sporadic. The contrast being that if an individual inherits, let's say, a breast cancer gene, is at a very high risk of getting the disease, although that the exact estimate of that risk is still evolving.
Okay.
Still being studied.
All right. I'd like to invite our listeners to join in the conversation, 800-989-8255. And let's go to Kristen in San Francisco, just next door. Kristen, what's your question?
Hi, my name's Kristen. I'm actually a medical student at UCSF. It's nice to talk to you, Dr. Bishop. My question.
Thank you. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
But be careful. He's the guy in charge, right?
I know. I'll have to ask a very good question, hopefully. I'd just like to say that I fully agree with you, and some of the points you've just elucidated indicate the importance of continuing to learn about science for the general public. I think one of the unfortunate parts is that even after high school, most people stop formally studying science, and a lot of the general public stops paying attention to it altogether. And I'm actually just wondering what your thoughts are on how to get to the general public and excite people about science and what's going on, particularly in light of how quickly things change.
First of all, I think if science instruction were more stimulating, more exciting, from grade school right through secondary school and college for those who attend college, that would help a great deal. I don't think we do that at all well. There are debates about how to do it well, but it's certainly, I know very few people who are close to the circumstances who believe that we do it well. We don't do it well. That would help a great deal, because once you get excited about science and what it, the understanding it offers us about how the world works and how we work, it's you never lose that. It's addictive, and I've had non-scientists say that to me. Secondly, the media are very important. If the press can convey to the public what's happening in science, why it's exciting, why it's important, in ways that are comprehensible, that's an immense assistance. That's why programs like this are important. That's why science sections in newspapers are important, and of course, they don't apparently have much market value. So science pages are the first or among the first things to go if there's a budget crunch at a newspaper. But I would say that improved education from grade school on, and the media, access through the media, are the two most important vehicles available to us to try to rectify the problem you raised.
But I'm curious, and thanks for the call, Kristen.
Thank you.
Okay. But I'm curious now, you know, other countries, when they do these literacy, science literacy tests, other countries frequently score higher than the United States, and I don't get the impression that their science education is so much more interesting. It seems to be valued more, perhaps, or something. So I wonder what you think about that. Is there an anti-science sentiment in this country for kids?
Oh,
or their
parents? I honestly do not understand the discrepancy. I know some of the explanations that are offered. I lived in Germany for a year several decades ago and saw that what we would equate there to secondary education here was more demanding and more rigorous. I think these so-called literacy tests examine proficiency at a point pretty close in time to the completion of a course. I'm much more concerned about the level of conceptual understanding among our citizens once they're adults and are voting and are living lives in this very complex culture, part of whose complexity arises from scientific and technological advances. And I think conveying a conceptual understanding of what science has learned about the world, the universe, is far more important for the general public than any technical proficiency, any ability to solve an equation, if you will.
All right.
And I don't think we do a good job of that. There was a nice interview in the New York Times with Shirley Tilghman, the president of Princeton University, this week, and she made this point that we don't teach science in a conceptual way to folks who aren't going to become scientists. It's one size fits all in our science instruction, and that's fundamentally a mistake.
Okay. Let's go to Julie in Miami, Florida. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to tell Dr. Bishop that I found his story very interesting and that my story is kind of the opposite of your story. I went to MIT, I guess I started in 1984, to study molecular biology and cell biology and to become a scientist. And I guess toward the end of my training, I discovered that I really didn't enjoy research at all. Although I found the ideas intellectually, you know, stimulating, the actual laboratory work was kind of, you know, not my thing. So I decided I wanted to take care of patients and go to medical school. And ultimately, I became a pathologist. And I also wanted to tell you that I thought it was great that that pathology fellowship really, you know, helped you out and, you know, changed your life.
What about that? Go ahead.
First of all, let me say that I'm sure that your scientific training has served you well as a physician.
Absolutely.
I'm sure it's brought a sense of rigor and a sense of inquiry and curiosity to your mm-hmm. practice that is valuable to your patients and gratifying to you.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so I think
it's
wonderful.
I just didn't like bench work.
Yeah, well, I loved it. I mean, I loved everything about science. I loved stuffing tubes full of things because I knew I was going to get an interesting answer. I loved writing papers, which I have to say is not common among scientists.
No, that's not common.
I even enjoyed writing grants because forced me to organize my ideas and critique them and make them coherent. So it takes all kinds, right?
Yeah, but and like you said, that you have a proclivity towards certain things, and I had a different one.
Yeah, I think the one conversion that isn't happening as often as it ought to for the health of our society is the conversion that I made from physician to scientist. The number of physicians who are becoming scientists as a career choice has been dropping in the United States for over a decade. And that's really unfortunate because a medically trained scientist brings a very special and important perspective to research, to medical research. And we are losing that cadre of scientists from this current generation, and I hope not the next, but very possibly the next as well.
Julie, thank you very much for your call.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. I need to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Stephen in Fair Oaks, California. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Dr. Bishop.
Hi.
I love Science Friday, and I love science in particular, even though I was an English major.
I think you share that with Harold Varmus, actually.
That's right.
But I wanted to ask you, when I heard your background early in the show, that your father was a preacher, I made the assumption that you had started out life metaphysically from a creationist standpoint. And I was wondering how your subsequent life and studies and training might have modified your view, if they have, about first cause of life and so forth. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks.
I did not start out life with a creationist viewpoint. I was raised in a clerical family that was relatively enlightened, that accepted the findings of science as they emerged. So I was halfway to where I am now already, even as a youth. But once I encountered the realities of science, once I came to understand the findings of science and the point at which they become essentially irrefutable, that moved me the rest of the way. I have this vivid recollection, which I recall in my book, of my comparative anatomy course in college. Now, this was a very pedestrian course. We simply looked at the anatomy of several animals, cats, frogs, and so forth, and saw how extraordinarily similar these various anatomies were, and saw how they changed over phylogenetic time from what an animal we call simpler to an animal we call more complex. And it was an astonishing revelation for me. I can remember it vividly. It was almost an aesthetic experience. That, of course, this is how species arose. They are so intimately related in structure and function, in a progressive manner, or what we call progressive. That was it. I hadn't really thought seriously about evolution before, but once I took that comparative anatomy course, I knew that the case as it had to be.
Interesting. So I'm torn because I have a serious question and a not so serious question before we end, which is coming up. But let me just ask quickly the serious question. Why did you step into an administrative job as the chancellor of UC San Francisco and not remain as a lab or scientist in the lab?
I speak to this in my book. There were several reasons. I guess the central one was that many of my colleagues thought that it would be good for the institution, for whatever reason, and that was important to me because the University of California, San Francisco has been my only employer since I got a degree. I've been there 35 years. It had nurtured my career in ways that were quite generous, so I felt I owed the place a debt, and if I could help it in this way, I would give it a try. Also, there are elements to the job that appeal to me. I'm not a monk. I enjoy people. I like politics. I like dealing with the general public, and those are all parts of my job.
Okay. And my last question.
So it was a complicated set of motivations.
But I have to ask you the last question. Do you think the San Francisco Giants can go all the way this year?
They're going to have to straighten out their starting pitching.
Okay. There you have it. Thanks very much, Dr. Bishop.
You're welcome, Joe. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. J. Michael Bishop is the 1989 Nobel laureate in Physiology or Medicine and author of How to Win the Nobel Prize, An Unexpected Life in Science, out this year from Harvard University Press. As earlier, we spoke with Richard Wilson, director of the Genome Sequencing Center at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Kevin Waite is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. If you have comments or questions, write to us. Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. Or email that's scifry@npr.org. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.